Welcome to the Buy and Build podcast, the show where we explore the nuances of buying and building small businesses with the focus on the UK and Europe. We are your hosts. I'm Paul.
And I'm David. If you are interested in buying, building or investing in UK and European small businesses, this show will dissect the strategies and insights of business owners, investors and other deal professionals that we meet along our journeys to acquire and invest in profitable small businesses.
If you enjoy the show, please follow us on your favorite podcast app to stay up to date on all new episodes.
And join the Buy and Build community at buyandbuild.co, where we plan to share additional resources and ideas with this community. You can also find us on Twitter at Buy and Build Podcast. And now, on to this week's episode.
This week, I'm excited to announce the podcast's first sponsor, Mark2Market. Mark2Market is the most sophisticated deal origination platform that I've seen in the UK. So a little background here. I reached out to Mark2Market around a year ago to inquire about their platform for my own use. But given it was initially designed with private equity in mind, it was almost too robust for what I needed. But they have taken that feedback on board and they've created an amazing solution for the acquisition entrepreneur. For a very competitive subscription amount, you're able to access their robust data analytics platform to scale your proprietary search. So no need for a costly buy-side advisor. And they have an aggregation platform for on-market deals supplied by accounting firms and corporate finance houses, which are arguably higher quality than a lot of the listings out there that tend to result in unrealistic expectations and wasted time. So visit marktomarket.io/buyandbuild to sign up or book a free demo and let them know who sent you. And you can also get 2 months free if you sign up for an annual subscription. Okay, welcome back to another episode of the Buy and Build podcast. This week, I'm very excited to have on Trish Higgins from Chenmark Capital. So Trish, it's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I'm excited that we could get this in the books. I know a bit about you, a bit about what Chenmark does from other podcasts that I've listened to, but I think the UK audience may be less familiar, so they're in for a treat. I actually sent around your publication you recently did on working capital a couple of weeks ago in our weekly newsletter and got some great feedback. So I think if anyone has not read that, I urge you to read it. It's an excellent breakdown of working capital and how you can optimize that. I mean, just an excellent, excellent piece and how it differs from when you're running the business to how it may seem like when you're looking at it as a university student, just looking at the numbers. But excellent piece.
On that piece, it's funny. I mean, I remember being in business school and being like, I don't like cash flow statement. Like, I don't need to worry about that. And then like 1 month into actually running a business, I was like, oh, that's a pretty important one. We should probably focus on that, learn a bit more about how all this stuff works. So yeah, something that gets very easily overlooked in an academic setting. And then when you're in a business, it's like your life.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, everyone loves EBITDA, and then you go speak to some lenders and they're like, well, what's actual cash flow here? And like, I'm not sure. What do you mean? You dig into it. Yeah,
exactly.
Oh, wow. Okay. This is the actual cash coming into this business. Maybe I can't actually do everything I thought I may do. So yeah. And I think you guys break it down in such a digestible way. I think it's fantastic. So I wanted to give a brief bio on you. And I kind of looked at your website quickly to take a few high level notes, even though I kind of have a bit of a background. And what I love is that you actually don't really speak about the three of you, yourself and your two partners very much. You focus on the values and interests and the broader team, which is great. But maybe we can just start there, a brief intro on yourself and Chenmark Capital.
Sure. So I started Chenmark with my husband and brother-in-law, which is kind of an odd group of people, back in 2015. And we all had a traditional finance background, not even really in operating businesses, but James was on the trading side. I was an analyst at a global macro hedge fund, and my brother-in-law was an equity research analyst. So we kind of had this idea that we wanted to buy small businesses and build a portfolio of them. And for a host of reasons, you know, kind of the more we looked into it, the more we said, hey, like, we think there's really something here and something that we can pursue. And so we sort of started off looking for businesses while we were still working. So it was kind of like a side thing that we did on the evenings and weekends. And then as it seemed like it might become like more of a reality, we, you know, sort of rolled off of our traditional paying jobs and did the search and ended up buying our first business, which was a commercial landscaping firm, and landscaping and snow removal firm up in Maine. And so we moved up to Maine and got involved in the world of small business. And so fast forward, I guess, 6-7 years since then, we now are still based in Portland, Maine, which is a very nice small town. And we own 9 businesses, what we would call a platform. So people, businesses that have their own CEOs and have done a number of tack-on acquisitions. So probably 30 acquisitions total since then, and have really been focusing on, you know, how do we become excellent at working with small business owners who are looking to retire, and the nuances and the quirkiness that comes with working in the deal process with small business owners. Lots of fun experiences there. And then, you know, that's sort of stage one. And then stage two is, how do we properly take care of these businesses for the long term once they're under our umbrella? So we always buy 100% of the business, and we put our own leadership in place. Sometimes we elevate people from within. So how do we sort of identify and train the next sort of generation of management in these companies? And then how do we bring kind of change management to a small business where, you know, sometimes things that sound really good, you know, in a PowerPoint presentation about some way a business should be optimized, really will fall flat on its face in a small business setting. And so knowing kind of what levers to really focus on once we own the business, and what to say, hey, you know what, this isn't perfect, but we're going to let it go, maybe get to that in a couple of years. And how do we make sure that we're owning these companies to be stable for the long term? So just a couple of like structural points. We're based in the US, we're a C Corp. We're sort of a holding company. All of our companies are LLCs, subsidiaries. And our sort of holy grail metric is free cash flow. Because as you mentioned, if you don't have free cash flow, you probably have a problem. And so a lot of things in our company are optimized around long-term free cash flow. And our kind of goal has always been to use the cash flows of the businesses to fund the equity check for the next business. So, you know, sometimes people think we're a fund or like a private equity or something like that. And we're really not. We're actually kind of an operating company ourselves that doesn't rely on external funding for deals. We're really sort of as good as our companies are. If our companies perform well and have excess free cash, then we have the ability to do deals. And if they don't, then we don't. So that's sort of the more the structural side of how we're set up. So yeah, that's the 3-minute overview of what's going on at Chinmark.
No, that's excellent. There's so much to dive in there. I love you guys have also written and spoken a lot about the fact that you like long-term compounding. And I like the fact, well, I love the fact that you guys are rolling cash flow into add-on into future acquisitions, which makes a lot of sense, and just keep reinvesting for that long-term compounding effect. So one thing I am curious about, because I guess I come from a slightly similar background. I worked at JP Morgan for 10 or so years. And I kind of stumbled upon this as a path, but it was a couple of years ago where you guys pulled the trigger, I'd say relatively early on before it really became popular to buy small businesses. I think it's been going on for some time, but it was really niche, whereas now it's kind of a little bit more popular, I would say, especially in the US. How did you guys think about, or how did you come across the idea of buying small business being actually an option to working on Wall Street?
Yeah. So, I mean, it definitely has blown up, and we've certainly benefited a little bit from that wave. And when we had the idea in 2014, we seemed like a little out there. I think that most of our friends and family members sort of thought we were having some sort of like weird midlife. I mean, we're only in our 20s, but like some sort of like identity crisis. And it's like, oh, they're going to like move to quit their jobs and they're moving to Maine and they're going to like mow lawns and just sort of like be like weird, like hippie landscaper people. And I think there's actually some of our friends who still think that's what we do. So the idea came about in a couple of ways. So I did go to business school and there were search fund classes. However, I did not take any of them, but I did have 2 very good friends who took them. And so I didn't really know what they were talking about, but I knew they took a class, and I was sort of like vaguely aware that this was like a thing that sometimes people do. I didn't know any of the details, but it was sort of like this concept, like in the side of my head. Sort of like I'm vaguely aware there are rules in like American football, but like I don't exactly know what they are. And so there was that. There was a newsletter called The Global Macro Investor by a guy named Raoul Paul, which is a wonderful newsletter. And he's since expanded it into other types of media. And my husband and I had been through work, had been followers of his work for, you know, since 2007, basically. So really enjoy his thought processes. And it was a number of years ago, but in some random piece, because they're quite long and have lots of things, he said sort of, you know, particularly in a lower interest rate environment where there's all sorts of excess capital, buying companies that actually yield, like yielding assets will be valuable. And he kind of went on to list, you know, car washes, laundromats, sort of things like that. And I remember just thinking like, oh, that's so interesting. Like I had never, for whatever reason, even though my family has a small business background, I'd never really like equated an interesting investment idea to businesses, like real businesses. Like for some reason, that connection in my brain had never happened. It was sort of like, oh, well, interesting investment ideas are like things that like hedge funds do. But like you can't have interesting investment ideas like outside of that. And for whatever reason, James and I remember reading that and just being like, oh, like that's interesting. And I wonder if there's anything to do there. And maybe, you know, we could buy a laundromat on the side, you know, and still have our day job, or just like it kind of like sparked a bit of interest and made that connection for us. And then the final piece was that Palmer had actually, he'd left JP Morgan. He was working at an educational startup, and he sort of felt that very clearly small team, you know, fat, strong personality of the founder. And, you know, Palmer was stepped into a COO role, and he could see there were kind of things that he would do differently if he owned the company and was in charge, because the owner was really running it as a lifestyle business and Palmer wanted to run it like as a profit maximizing business. And so we're all very close, and we were all actually living together at the time. We didn't have any kids or anything. And so we had a lot of time to hang out. And this kind of concept of, I think it was James and Palmer, you know, saying like, hey, like maybe we could try to buy this business. And then we like, these are the things we could do with it and whatever. And like that didn't like pan out at all. But the confluence of all of those things made us think like, hey, like maybe there's like something to do here. And I talk to people now who sometimes like they come with me and they have like this big plan of like they're creating this holding company and they're going to do all this stuff and blah, 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 which is like great. And they are like well ahead of the curve I was when I started. But like for us, it was very much and still is an organic incremental process where we said, hey, you know, that's interesting. Let's look into that more. It was literally like Google, like how do you buy a business? And then like you're on like those like biz buy sell or whatever. And you're clicking and you're like, oh, like this one looks interesting. And you click and you send the email form. Sometimes they get back to you, this random, you know, broker, you talk to them. And so it was very incremental. And the more that we dug into it, the more it sort of proved out our thesis. And then we sort of went from there. And I think that at the time, the notion of we're this family group, that we're going to do it together, that we want to have a long-term hold, and that we want to have multiple companies was very odd. And I think because the model was really, you know, don't do it with family. You buy one company, you grow it, you sell it after whatever, 5 to 7 years, then you like move on to your next thing. And like, maybe if you're lucky over time, you could become an like investor in search funds. And I think that we've created our own little pocket that works for us. And I think is a reflection of our path. And I still think that this space is so fragmented and nascent that there's room for so many different models. And I don't think there's one that's like, oh, well, you got to do it this way. And I know there's like debates over like funded versus non-funded or like this type of and it's like, that's fine. But like the truth is there's no correct answer. It's just like, you know, people can just figure out like what works for them. You know, the Chenmark model works for us. It, you know, probably doesn't work for other people, and that's totally fine. So I think for us, it's just been very organic and kind of incremental and kind of in how we've grown. But that said, as soon as we came up with, we want to own companies for the long term, we want to have a portfolio, and we want to be internally funded, like that has been a constant. And it still is a constant. And I think it would take a lot for us to shift off of that.
Yeah, I mean, really helpful and really interesting. So you touched on that your two friends that you knew had taken search fund classes, and you, all your acquisitions have been kind of self-funded from free cash flow. But that first acquisition, was that, it sounds like probably self-funded, but you, did you go kind of like the SBA route, or how was that first deal structure that kicked everything off?
Yeah. So the first one, we were self-funded, just easier to do when you still have a day job. And then we ended up in that first deal, we had seller's role equity. We had a large seller note, and then the remaining equity was ourselves and some friends and family. So we didn't have a huge equity need for the first one because of the way that we structured it. And to be honest, like, we kind of had to structure it that way because nobody would give us money. we had a couple of initial conversations with people and stuff, and it was just like, we got absolutely nowhere. So we were a little bit backed into like, well, we have to do a deal structure that like is feasible for us.
I bet those people are kicking themselves now. And was that on the debt side or the equity side?
On the equity side.
Okay. Because you didn't want to take on any debt or?
You know what? It just so happened that in this deal, the sellers were okay with a large seller note. So that just kind of like was luck, you know, that wasn't strategic.
So now going forward, free cash flow finances future acquisitions, but how are they structured? Is it a component of, does that free cash flow make up equity and then there's a portion of debt, or how do you structure deals typically now?
Sure. So we use a combination of debt and equity. Of the debt, we really push and generally always have some form of a seller note. And that's because we have not done earnouts. We're working with owners who are retiring, exiting the business. So an earnout doesn't really make sense for us. A seller note, it still is a way of like tying the owner to a successful transition, to helping us out. And if somebody really doesn't want to give a seller note, you have to wonder like what's going on here. And then what we do, because we had this experience a couple times at the beginning where, you know, we'd figure out all the transaction stuff. And then like later in the process, it would be like, okay, well, let's say the deal's whatever, I don't know, $1 million, but like, we're going to pay you whatever, you know, cash at close, but it's going to be minus this like escrow amount that we're going to like, is going to be held at our whatever lawyer's account for, I don't know, a year to make sure that everything that you said in your legal doc and like what you represented to us is accurate. And that caused a lot of anger then, and people feeling like we were introducing something at like the last minute. There was like a bait and switch type thing. And I think it was one of our lawyers suggested in the early days, you know, if you have a seller note, then you can get rid of escrow and you can just have like offset rights. So if something comes up and let's say it's like a $50,000 whatever claim, then instead of like taking it out of your escrow amount, you can just like reduce the seller note by that amount. And that like helped sort of ease like just one of many hurdles there are in closing a small business deal. And so, you know, we kind of tell the seller like some cash is being held back regardless. So like you might as well earn some interest on it, right? So that's kind of the seller note structure. We typically have paid around 4 times for our deals. So like back of the envelope for each deal is like 50% equity, 50% debt. To be honest, as we've grown over time and have been paying off debt, we look at our metrics more from like a holding company perspective, which allows us as we grow, each incremental deal can actually be a bit more levered because we are overall delevering. And so we're actually, you know, close to a scenario where, depending on the size of the deal, you know, we could actually very aggressively debt finance it because overall our metrics are actually like still going down. But we started off being very, very true to that kind of 50-50 ratio, very frugal on multiples. So you know, if anything was like above 4.5 times, like everybody was freaking out and still kind of does. And it was really not until like the past year, so 5-ish years in, that we've started being like, okay, maybe we can be a little more aggressive in our underwriting, not do 50-50 and increase it a little bit, reduce the equity check, and sort of shifted our mindset to more global leverage as opposed to local leverage.
Very interesting. Yeah. In the UK, we use the term deferred consideration.
It sounds fancier.
Yeah. It's not as common to have an interest component linked to that. And yeah, to your point, obviously you can claw some of that back if there's any issues, but also if it's a cash flow lender that's getting on board, they will typically require at least some kind of deferred component over 2 years to know that the seller has skin in the game. So sometimes it's easy to kind of, when you're messaging that to an owner, just say, okay, well, you know, it's not me. The lenders really are pushing for this.
That is helpful.
All right. But this is really, really interesting. So you said upfront you had done, or you have done now, around 30 acquisitions, including add-ons and then 9 platform companies. So do you mind giving just touching on the 9 platforms, the kind of sector and geographic breakdown and how those work together?
Yeah. So it is diversified. So we have kind of concentrations. We have 3 traditional commercial landscaping snow removal businesses in New England, 1 lawn care company, which is kind of big picture, same industry. In detail, it's actually a very different company, a lawn care tick and mosquito control company. And that's throughout New England as well. We have a boat, like a tourism business in Maine. We have a tourism business in Florida. We have a agricultural business in Tennessee. And we have a food manufacturer in Western Canada and a paint distributor in Western Canada as well. I am from Western Canada, so it's not as random as it sounds, but we can only have geographic sort of spread in the company if we have really high quality, trustworthy, competent people running the business. And so as we have been able to develop relationships with people who we think are wonderful operators and trustworthy and understand the long-term vision of Chenmark and want to be part of it, we felt more comfortable going further away. But we go into that knowing that if there is a problem, you know, one of the 3 of us will be spending a lot of time potentially away from home if there's a problem. And we go into that eyes wide open. And that's a kind of risk that we are comfortable taking.
Okay, that's clear. So maybe that's a good topic to touch on, because I've heard obviously some of your previous conversations around some of you guys having to step in as CEO of your portfolio companies. And you'd mentioned also, I think, when you acquire 100%, you bring in talent. So how do you think about, one, bringing in talent versus second-tier management? And then, so maybe we'll start on that, and then we can go into some of the businesses where you guys have had to step in. I think those are cool stories.
Sure. So the first thing we do always when we meet with a business owner is to say, is there anybody in your business that should be taking over? And 3 of our businesses are actually run by people who were in the business before who have been elevated to a CEO role. And that actually is a wonderful model and sometimes can solve a lot of problems, because sometimes an owner will have a second in command that's been there forever. And in an ideal world, they would transition to that person, but that person doesn't have the money to pay them. And they don't necessarily want to give, you know, 95% seller note or something and still be kind of like tied to the business. Like the person wants to retire and move on, have financial liquidity and security and all that. And so in 2 scenarios specifically, we've been able to play that role to say, hey, you know, we vetted the second in command person. We feel comfortable with them taking on a CEO role. And, you know, we're going to facilitate this. And so in those situations, you know, you really have to feel comfortable with the person that's second in command. And you have to feel comfortable that, you know, that person wasn't the CEO before. So they were probably the head of operations or head of sales or something of that nature. And that just like anybody, it's going to take them a period of time to kind of grow into their new role and kind of have to feel comfortable with making sure you're providing that person the support to, you know, kind of transition from maybe you've been COO for 10 years, you know, now you have to be CEO, that could take 12 months to understand the differences in what your job really is. Well, that's always step one. And if that's the case, like that actually is wonderful. Step two, where we're bringing in our own people. So we did have some owners stay on in the early days. I think that those relationships didn't necessarily like weren't the most productive because we didn't necessarily know what we were looking for. And I think that the sellers sometimes like would hear what they wanted to hear about what life would be like after the transition. And maybe we didn't necessarily like correct them because we wanted a deal to get done. Like particularly in the early days, I think it's easy to kind of be like, yeah. Like let's get the deal done. And then after the fact, you're kind of not on the same page about like what operationally everybody's roles are, especially since we have a strong finance background. We've had a couple of cases where, you know, the sellers are sort of like, oh, well, these people are here now. So like, I don't have to worry about the finances because like they know finance stuff. And we're like, well, no, like that's still your job. And so there's definitely been confusion around that. And so now we just find it much easier just to be clear to say, hey, like we're looking to work with people who want to retire, who want out. If they want some sort of consulting role or some sort of involvement in the business, like we can talk about that, but they're not going to be like the leader person. You know, then the question is who's going to be the leader? We had a couple of situations where we wanted to get a deal done. So we just kind of hired somebody that, you know, just like job post, like hire somebody that we didn't know. And I think that in those cases, again, what we're trying to optimize for long-term free cash flow is a very unique thing. And we're trying to, you know, we have our own specific set of values and our own sort of like playbook that we've been developing over, you know, a number of years at this point. And it's very hard for somebody just to like, who already has professional experience, to just like walk right into that because they have, you know, a different playbook and a different sort of, even if you say like, we're interested in whatever free cash flow, like if a person has been optimizing for revenue growth their entire career and never really thinking about profit, because whatever, a lot of people do that, it's very hard for them to all of a sudden have like a new, you know, set of tools to execute, right? And so we, a couple of years ago, we said, hey, you know, if we want to grow and do more acquisitions, we need to be bringing people into Trendmark earlier. And they need to kind of go through a training program so that when we have a new acquisition, we can go in-house and say, listen, team, here are, you know, here's the company, this is the deal, this is the location, you know, who is interested, and that we can have those people go and run the businesses. So it's sort of, I'd say a lot of the people who are in that program where you kind of start off doing more analytical consulting work across the portfolio. So you get an opportunity to kind of see all the businesses, make connections, see all sorts of different things, kind of understand how we work. Then they go work in one of the businesses as like COO or CFO or something like that to get hands-on operational experience. And then that's the pool that can raise their hand for new CEO opportunities. So far, thankfully, that program has been working for us. And I think it's because we're taking the time to really make sure, you know, people are vetted before they step into the role. And so right now we have 4 businesses that are being run by people who have gone through that program. And I'd say, you know, the limiters to growth for us are, can our companies generate free cash? And can we, you know, recruit and sort of develop people internally so that we actually have people to lead new businesses? Because we have said, and when I tell sellers this all the time, if I don't feel like I have somebody to run the business, we're not going to do the deal. And like, we'll be transparent about that. It's one of the first things that we have to look at internally. But if I don't have someone to run it, like I can't do it. And the right owners actually want that. You know, they want to sell to people. And we bring sort of the person who's going to be CEO, like into the diligence process. They're the one, they develop relationships with the owners. You know, they're very involved in that transition, but they didn't necessarily find the company. So yeah, that's how we think about that.
That's fascinating. I mean, I can see how early on, I mean, I guess I am early on in my journey, how, you know, you just want at times to get the deal done, and, you know, however that senior management shakes out, you hopefully it's the right fit. But it's cool now that you've been able to kind of build a bench almost and then pull in internal people. So it sounded like there was a year or so as like an, like almost like a private equity type role where you're kind of looking at all companies and doing a bit of analytical work, and then a COO role, then eventually CEO role. What's the typical avatar of the person that may want to look for that kind of an opportunity?
Yeah. So we've spoken with enough small business owners to know they don't all come in like one shape and size. So we try to keep a really open mind when it comes to interviewing people for the process, because, you know, some CEOs might have not great, let's say, finance skills, but they could be amazing salespeople, right? And so it's kind of about making sure we're not just saying, well, this only one type of person, because I think that would do a disservice, because different businesses also need different types of leaders. That said, the similarities are there has to be a baseline of analytical thinking. So it doesn't have to be, you don't have to be a math like whiz, but you do have to be able to like look at some, you know, a situation and translate that into numbers and kind of be like, you know, does this make sense? Not. And there has to be kind of like an ability to think analytically. So that's sort of step like one kind of baseline. The next sort of skills-based baseline is just, you know, in a small business, you need to be able to do like 100 things all in one day and feel comfortable with that. So we look more for sort of like all-round athletes, you know, people who can kind of, maybe they have no background in marketing, but like they feel comfortable like, you know, stepping into a marketing meeting and trying to figure, you know, pick things up, figure it out, can ask questions, but then switching into some HR issue and sort of people who aren't just like, well, you know, I just do this one thing and I sit behind a desk all day and just do that is like not enough. Like you have to be sort of like broad in your interests and skill set and all that sort of stuff. And then the final one, probably the most important, is just sort of cultural fit. You know, people who want to be, who want to help us build Chenmark because they're interested and excited by that opportunity, who want to think for the long term and, you know, truly want to be in the space. I'd say the biggest issue we have is that we'll get people who want to come work for us, but they really just want to be like financial analysts. Like they just want to like sit in HQ and, I don't know, do like analytical, like finance stuff all the time. And the reality is like, that's not just really a job at Chenmark. Like the job is getting out into the field, leading people, you know, running operations, like that is the value. And so one, we have like a strong aversion to like overhead. And two, I think that people who just want to like sit in Portland and be like an analyst kind of like miss the mark on like the point of Chenmark. So it's kind of making sure we filter out people who just want that and just like actually understand like it's about being in the businesses.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Do you think that's a result of all three of your backgrounds coming from Wall Street, or where are you recruiting, you know, these kinds of people?
So, I mean, some of it is that we did some early podcasts just sort of randomly, but they were had more of a finance investment audience. So certainly have gotten exposure to that, which has overall been like great. But it also, I think, sometimes talks to people who aren't, don't really understand like small business operations. So that kind of is probably part of it. For recruiting, you know, we do talk to a lot of business schools, not because you need to have gone to business school to work for us, but it's just a natural place because people are aware of search funds and they're also looking for jobs. So that's helpful. We get a fair amount of like inbound from people who've heard us on a panel somewhere or a podcast or something like that. So it's a little bit organic in that way. And it's not like we need to hire like 100 people. I think we can only really successfully have kind of like 1 to 3 people in kind of like the first step at any given time, because, you know, otherwise they're not getting the attention and training they should be having. And so, you know, we're sort of, it's a constant rolling process. You know, we have one person starting in, I don't know, a month or so. We've got to have one person starting like every month for the next like 3 or 4 months. So like we have a little bit of a pipeline, people are rolling in and out. But yeah, it's sort of a constant thing. I think as we grow, probably like the most, one of like the, probably the most important part of Chenmark is keeping that pipeline going.
Interesting. I mean, it's a fantastic concept. And I think for the right person listening or listening to this or listening to other podcasts, they'll know when it kind of hits them because it's a very specific type of role. So they'll know, okay, this sounds exactly like the right type of fit for me.
Yeah, we get a lot of, hey, I just heard you on X podcast. I'd like to apply sort of thing. And they just send an email. And we get a fair amount of that.
Cool. Awesome. All right. I wanted to speak about kind of the leadership roles within the business and kind of touched on it earlier. I've previously listened to an episode that you guys did where, you know, you guys have had to step into the CEO roles yourselves at times. Do you mind talking through some of those stories? And are any of you doing that now still?
Yeah. So the first time that happened was Palmer stepped in. He runs our lawn care business now. And that sort of happened because we had hired somebody in, again, somebody who was very focused on revenue growth. So revenue grew a lot and profits went down, which for us is like the absolute like worst thing. You know, we don't care about revenue. So we decided we had to make a change. And this was early on and we didn't have this program. And so we're a little bit in a bind because it was sort of like, well, who, like there has to be somebody to run the business, but we don't think that the person who is currently running it is the right fit. So Palmer had done the diligence and kind of led the deal. He was very up to speed then. And then that space kind of lends itself more to growth via acquisition, at least a couple of years ago before valuations were crazy. And so he had been doing a lot of the acquisition work. And so he was the closest to the business. He understood, he knew what was going on. He'd worked the most with the business. And so it made the most sense for him to step in. You know, it seemed sort of like a, you know, step in for a year, you know, just as a bridge and we'll kind of figure it out. And to be honest, he really loves it. And he, you know, has a vision of where he wants to take the company and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And so, you know, he's kind of there until he doesn't want to be there or he feels like his work is done in terms of where he wants to take the business. So that sort of started off as a like, hey, we need to step in and do this and we'll figure it out into sort of like, that's what he does now. And he really enjoys it. And like, that's great. And he does an amazing job. And, you know, so that's kind of that. In terms of I stepped in to run a business and that was deliberate. Palmer had moved on. He was running the business. So then I took over search when he became CEO. And there was a business that was sort of, you know, about an hour away from where we are. So not too far away, very clearly an owner who wanted to retire, but nobody that, you know, we didn't even meet anybody in the business before it sold. So nobody that it was clear, you know, could take over from day one. And I had always sort of wanted to do some operational work and have that experience. So it kind of worked out because I was like, well, you know, we need someone to run this and it's not that far away from home. And like, I want this experience. So that has been great. And I've had a good time doing that. I have been very deliberate there though on hiring and training people to make me like irrelevant. And so that was 2 years ago. I'd say at this point now, I sort of have told them sort of, you know, they're really taking care of things. I wouldn't really call myself like a true CEO of that business because it's not that big of a business in terms of headcount. And like, they just don't need that many people there directing traffic. So, you know, I sort of talk about myself there now more as like the owner as opposed to like the CEO. And so that seems to be going well, but that's been sort of like a gradual transition and has been really wonderful to have sort of operational experience. So maybe I'll jump into another role at some point, but we've got all these like super talented people who on our team now who, you know, want that role. So they probably take a priority over me at this point.
Yeah, no, but I mean, I guess similar to you coming from like a more capital allocation background, it's TBD whether I will be a good operator, but I'm very excited about the prospect of operating a small business. I think at the very least, it'll make you a better capital allocator. And you may just love the operational side anyway.
Yeah, it's hard to know until you're in it. And it is fun to have an idea and then see it come to reality. like in that very direct way. You know, we talk about like having an impact, like, you know, as the leader of a small business, you have a very direct impact on how the business does, as well as sort of like the people in the business. And you can really change people's trajectories, which is very cool and very rewarding, and in a way that you can't really if you're just like in a purely capital allocating role. And so that part of it is really fun. And you know, honestly, like I kind of just enjoy doing like the business I took over is a tourism business. So I just kind of enjoy talking with like the customers and, you know, just more like frontline stuff like that. You know, I don't mind working in a ticket booth. Like to me, that's like a perfectly fine way to spend my day. Like, you know, that's a fun thing to do.
Okay. So one fun question, I guess I've been thinking about, given your diversification in the portfolio group, which of the 9 platform companies are the most difficult to run? Obviously, it doesn't really go down to like the business itself, but like just structurally, like maybe it's a working capital issue or seasonality or something like that.
Yeah, I would say that working capital is the biggest issue in the landscaping businesses, particularly because of where we live. You know, there's clearly a winter and a spring. So we really run 2 businesses. We run like a snow removal business and a landscaping business. And the working capital needs, particularly like around this type of year, because in landscaping, you get paid with a contract for the season. Different companies have different length contracts, but let's say it's a 6-month contract, 7-month contract, but it's like split equally by each month. So it's whatever the number is divided by 7. But the problem is that spring cleanups, which is, you know, going out and cleaning up people's yards and doing all that sort of stuff and mulching and whatever, that's probably like 60 or 70% of the work. And that all happens in like a month or 6 weeks or whatever. Depends on when the weather breaks and it becomes spring. And so you have to hire everybody. You have to get them onboarded. You have to get them out. They have to do all the work, but you don't collect the payments, you know, until September or whatever. And so when we only had landscaping companies, this time of year was very tight from a cash perspective because you had all these outlays, but you couldn't match the payments with the amount of work done. And so, I mean, I think that there are companies that are good at managing this. And the benefit that we've had from owning a couple different companies, we can see how different people do it. And so there are things you can do in your contracts. And so this kind of goes back to like the working capital discussion. But in that situation, you know, for instance, when are you sending out your contract? So let's say your contract is supposed to start on April 1st. You know, are you sending the contract out on April 7th and it's then 30-day terms? Or are you sending it out on March 15th, due April 1st? So you can still have 30-day terms, but when are you sending out the contract? What's it dated as of? And then like, what's your process to follow up on it? And I'm sure we've all had these experiences in our personal lives with dealing with vendors. Cause I know sometimes like somebody will come do work at our house for, I don't know, fix something that's broken. And like, I won't get a bill until like a month later and it's 30-day terms. So, like they're not getting paid like till 2 months after they did the work. Whereas like there's some other people who, you know, they'll demand payment like when they're there, you know, like a credit card, whatever, you know, everywhere in between. There are other people who, you know, they'll send you an invoice like on April 1st in this example. It's not due to the 30th, but like they'll follow up with me on the 7th to be, hey, did you see the invoice? Are you going to pay it? And, you know, usually when I get that email, I just pay it, even though like I don't really have to pay it to the end of the month. And so the landscaping businesses, the fact that those were our first businesses, I think like really made us have to pay very close attention to those dynamics, because you can face yourself in a very, you know, in a cash crunch in that period of time. And if you talk to a lot of landscapers, they talk about sort of, you know, the fall being like the quote unquote, like those are the profitable payments. And it's like, well, like based on accrual accounting, like no, but like on cash accounting, you're right. Because like all of your contract stuff that's coming in like September, like you're doing very little work other than maybe some like weekly mowing and weeding. And so like, yes, like more cash is staying in the bank in the fall. So those are, I'd say, structurally the ones you have to keep the closest eye on, because if you're not managing all that stuff properly on a daily basis, like you can run into trouble.
Yeah, got it. Yeah, and then just to echo the earlier point of going back and looking at that article that you did with Yale on working capital, I think it just, you know, wraps everything together really nicely on this topic. So one last one, Trish, I know we're coming up on time. I think I kind of know the answer to this question, but I wanted to ask it anyway. So like I said earlier on, you guys are proponents of long-term compounding. So there's obviously no exit plans per se, but what are the long-term plans for Chenmark?
That is a good question. So we don't have like a number, like, you know, there's no, which is odd because we're very like number of people, but we don't have like a number of companies or a revenue or a cash flow target. We just know that we want to do this for the long term, and that what we call like the flywheel of like, we have more companies, they generate more cash, we can buy more companies. That's really what we're excited about, and like excited about scaling up with that process, and have spent a lot of time and resources kind of building things today that could say, hey, you know, what if we had 20 companies? What if we had 50 companies? Like, what are the things, programs and processes that need to be put in place to help support us like on that path? And I think if we only wanted 9 companies or 10 companies or whatever, like honestly, like we could actually like scale down a lot of what we're doing now and just kind of like kick it into neutral. But for us, it's sort of like, let's get the flywheel going and like see where it takes us. And I think that the one thing that we have over time, you know, we do think there is a lot of opportunity in this small space. I think people ask us, you know, are you going to do bigger deals? And I'd say like, we could, but we are very value conscious and there's so much competition for bigger deals that I can't really ever see us paying up for a bigger deal. And I also think that the small business space is very easy to dismiss by larger allocators, and they sort of, you know, it's kind of like not worth their time. And as a result, I think there's opportunity there. It's a very inefficient market. It's very fragmented. And so if we can become experts at just staying in the smaller size, and I wouldn't say we're experts now. We have still, I think, have a lot of work to do on how to source and do the acquisition process and operate in an excellent way. I think we're on our way to learning that, but we've got work to do. If we can just stay focused and become really excellent at that, I think we can do like a lot of cool things. So that's like a very non-answer to your question, but that's how we think about it.
No, but that's great. I mean, I think it's a really good answer. So you just, you know, there's no, it's more about the process than any quantitative goal, which is great, because you have to enjoy the process if you're embarking on something like this anyway. So it's like with anything like fitness or health or anything like that, you need to enjoy the process, right? So that's great. And looking forward to see where that takes you, because you've already done some really cool things. So yeah, looking forward to see how that evolves and maybe have you on again sometime down the line to talk about future acquisitions or anything else that's going on. It would be a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. Would be happy to. And best of luck in your own acquisition process.
Yeah, thank you. Hopefully that goes smoothly. We'll see how it goes, but fingers crossed. But yeah, thanks again, Trish. Really, really great to have you on. And I'm sure the listeners are going to take a lot out of this. And you guys obviously put out a lot of resources that they should check out. Your weekly newsletter is great. I mentioned the publication. Is there anything else that you'd like to leave with the listeners? Anywhere to reach you or?
Yeah. Info@Chenmark is our catch-all. It actually goes directly to me. So it's basically like emailing me. and then I forward along to, you know, different people, if whoever's appropriate. So that's probably the best place to reach us. And then certainly, you know, our weekly thoughts is a good opportunity to one follow along, but we have heard a lot of people use weekly thoughts as a way to engage with sellers by forwarding them an article saying, I thought you might be interested in this or that sort of thing. So it's kind of out there, but very happy for people to use it as a tool to stay in touch with people.
Excellent. Cool. Well, thank you again, Trish. This has been excellent. I know we're coming up on time now and you obviously have a very, very busy day, I imagine, ahead of you. So thanks again. And hopefully we can chat soon.
Sounds good. Thank you so much. Appreciate being on.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Buy and Build podcast. If you enjoyed the episode, please follow the show on your favorite podcast app to stay up to date on all new episodes. If you'd like to support the show, please share it with others you think might be interested.
You can also join the Buy and Build community at buyandbuild.co, where we plan to share additional resources and ideas with this community. You can also find us on Twitter at Buy and Build Podcast.